Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Vice President Mike Pence comes to town as part of the advance for the 2020 convention. Democratic presidential candidates also descend on Charlotte. Charlotte City Council makes news with zoning and at least one councilman's desire for a pay raise. Even though it is other states that are passing restrictive abortion laws, Charlotte is the site for several demonstrations, and a Panthers headquarters move seems highly likely at this point. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those stories and others, and those reporters include Alex Olgan from WFAE News. Good morning. Welcome.
Morning.
Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and a contributor to WCCB-TV News Rising. I think that's what it's called. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Good
morning. Glenn Birkins is back. He's editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Hi.
Good morning, Mike.
And Jonathan Lowe is a reporter anchor for Spectrum News in Charlotte. Welcome to you.
Good morning, Mike.
Good to see you. After 15 months, Charlotte will be in the midst, in the next 15 months, of the 2020 Republican National Convention, but planning is already underway, as you might imagine. And as I mentioned, Vice President Mike Pence was here to preview preparations. What did he see?
A lot. He spent basically an entire day in North Carolina. He started here in Charlotte, got here around noon, immediately went to a plant out in Union County in Monroe, Parkdale Mills. Mm-hmm. They are, what we learned, leading in spun fabrics, basically. And so he started there, did a tour of that plant, and basically spoke to employees there about the U.S.-Canada-Mexico trade agreement, and then left here, went to Greensboro, where he attended a private, what was called, quote, Trump victory event up in Greensboro. Was basically a fundraiser for U.S. Senator Tom Tillis, who was facing a re-election bid.
Yeah. Was this whole thing billed as the kickoff event or just a part of it? Because the kickoff event,
correct,
officially was not open to the media.
No, it was not.
Why not?
Good question. I think that they're
why wouldn't you want that to be open to the media?
We tried, I think they are still getting their ducks in a row, and there are still a lot of questions about having the RNC in Charlotte. Okay. I know that the city council is still getting, someone city council is still getting pushback on that. So I can only imagine that's why we weren't allowed in.
Mary?
Well, you'll see them a lot more. You'll see folks, you'll see Vice President Pence. You will probably see President Donald Trump here for many reasons. One, of course, the RNC. And, you know, the last time they only won the state by about 4%. So North Carolina is definitely a swing state. And then Tom Tillis is facing a really tight race. Democrats are still trying to recruit a high-profile person to run against him, but he's thought to be in a somewhat weakened position, and it's a targeted state for the Senate.
Isn't he facing a Republican challenger, though?
He's also facing a Republican challenger, yes. And so, yeah, he needs that support. And Democrats have said if they have any chance of winning the Senate, that they need to win North Carolina.
So I just want to follow up on something you said, Jonathan, just a second ago about the reason it may have been closed to the media is because of some pushback about the RNC coming here in the first place. But Mike Pence reflected on this, and he said that the event showed strong civic support.
I think others will question that.
Who was there for the event, the official kickoff event? Do we know?
No, the only person that we know is there is John Lasseter, who is leading the effort, who is the chair of the fundraising committee. Other than that, it's not really known who. I can only imagine some of the top people in the Mecklenburg GOP were there as well.
So when Mike Pence was at Parkdale Mills, one of the things that he talked about was something that's becoming a talking point now, mm-hmm, in the administration and in the Trump campaign, is that it's time for Democrats to move away from trying to reinvestigate and relitigate the past and move to issues that Americans care about most. Did that was that event open to the public?
Yes, it was.
Okay, did that seem to resonate with people there?
I don't know, because this whole, you have to do some research about this whole, it's really a national tour that the vice president is on. Clearly the president has sent him out to be, you know, the mouthpiece for this U.S.-Canada-Mexico trade agreement, because it has been signed by all three countries. It was signed back in October. The sticking point, and this all relates back to the impeachment conversation, Congress has not taken this up, and Democrats are not going to let this through because, you know, of other things that are going on between the Trump White House and Congress.
They said they could chew gum and walk at the same time.
Well, correctly. Yeah. So the vice president obviously is on a tour trying to sell the American public. He even went as far as to encourage the people in the audience, who were not the public. It was the employees of the business and the media, but encouraging people to contact their legislator to push them to, you know, get Congress to approve this deal. So there's obviously a reason why he's on this tour.
Glenn. When you ask, did it resonate with the people in attendance? One thing you have to remember is that when you're dealing with political events at that level, they're highly staged.
Mm-hmm. No.
Yeah, they are. Surprise, surprise.
It was very staged.
So, you know, they always stage it to show it.
Was there dancing and singing? That's all I want to know.
There were plenty of signs, though, and you can see Donald Trump, yes, is pushing this in the fact that he walked out of the infrastructure meeting with Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, basically saying, I won't work on anything else until they drop the investigations. And Democrats saying, you know, that's our job.
Right.
That's the investigations. We can do oversight and legislation at the same time.
When the Democratic convention was here, we had a little fundraising difficulty, in part because Barack Obama, the candidate at the time, would not allow major donors to come and support the convention. They had to get small packets of money from people, and that left a big deficit at the end. I think Duke Energy had to help pay it off. How are they doing in the fundraising department? Because evidently the local host committee for the RNC has to raise $70 million. A lot of money.
50 of which is required by the federal government just okay. because of the security requirements there. I can only imagine that's why they're keeping things pretty private, because they, you know, asking questions of them of where they stand on fundraising.
Do we know?
I don't think we know an amount, but they've indicated that they're doing very well.
Right.
Well, they announced this week that Greensboro businessman Louis DeJoy will lead the committee's fundraising efforts. This is the local host committee, local being Charlotte, and they've hired a Greensboro guy to run it, the fundraising. Why is somebody from Greensboro leading Charlotte's committee?
Just because, and look at the connection, though. I mean, that's where the...
He's a major donor to the Republican Party.
Right, and that's where the private, you know, quote, right. Trump victory event was held okay. after the vice president left Charlotte.
So one of the reasons the Republican National Convention is coming here, we are presuming, is that North Carolina is in play. It's, mm-hmm. it's a swing state, and it explains the reason for the vice president's visit this week as well, and why so many Democratic presidential contenders are coming to Charlotte and the area, not just Charlotte. Cory Booker was here. Beto O'Rourke has been here. Mayor Pete Buttigieg has spent time in Rock Hill. Bernie Sanders was out in the broiling sun with Mary.
Julian Castro was up in Durham yesterday.
Marching with Reverend William Barber and right. talking about housing and minimum wage.
So North Carolina has 15 electoral votes. How important does that make us?
Very important.
Extremely.
Yeah, it's very important. And particularly when we're one of those states, you see, we'll see all of them many times, because many states, the electoral votes are baked in. But North Carolina is one of those swing states, and so you'll see the candidates returning again and again. And particularly when you have so many Democratic candidates, So they'll be here before the primary.
Yeah. So the one candidate that had, I think, the biggest so far, Mary and I were there, was Bernie Sanders last Friday, correct?
Yes, and it's really important for him to get it because he was a juggernaut the last time in 2016, and he really hit the wall in the South because in the South, basically, the parties have lined up racially, and many black voters are Democrats and many white voters are Republicans, and he did not do very well with African-American voters, particularly the drivers, African-American women.
Then this time around, what's different about Bernie Sanders that he'll be able to win that vote?
Well, he's changed his message a bit because he was, of course, basically economic inequality, right? And the complaint was that he didn't recognize that there's really always in America a racial component to that. So he is talking about justice.
What does that mean?
Well, it's the cornerstone, you know, economic, racial, social. And you'll see also when he was in South Carolina right after, he unveiled an education plan he called it after Thurgood Marshall, and this is about 65 years after the Brown v. Board of Education decision, where he was looking for economic and social and racial justice in the school system. And the person that spoke before him was a former legislator from Ohio, Nina Turner, who's African-American, and that was very strategic as well.
The other thing that's different about him this year is not so much that he's different. It's just that the party in general has moved to the left, or at least the candidates. So, 3 years ago he was considered a far left candidate, but now he's been flanked on the left by several people running for office.
So one of the things that he really impressed upon or talked a lot about, though, talked about the social justice, the raising the minimum wage to $15. This was also happening last week when Alabama and before that it was Georgia had passed those really restrictive abortion laws. And so he, there were a lot of women in the audience, young and older women, who he certainly got a lot of applause when he spoke to how damaging he thought that those restrictive laws are, and the fact that he really believes in a woman being able to control her own body.
And he did it in classic Bernie fashion by saying, these laws are going to send women back to the arms of quacks. And,
Alex. Where his message hasn't changed, though, is health care. But I think the public has shifted. He had a town hall on Fox News, and I think that they were surprised when how enthusiastic people were about Medicare for the, quote, Medicare for all public option.
This is Bernie you're talking about.
Yeah,
this is interesting because Bernie was well-received on Fox News. Pete Buttigieg was well-received on Fox News. What's up with Fox News?
Well, they're not staging their events that way.
Well, President Trump isn't very happy about this. He's very much complained that they are interviewing folks.
But it's not just the fact that they're interviewing people, because some Democrats will go, others will not go, and the ones that are going are pretty smart to go. But they're holding these town hall meetings with people who one would presume are Fox News viewers, and they're liking what they're hearing. That should be very frightening to some people.
Well, it's legitimizing Fox in a way because they have so many right-wing commentators. They want to emphasize, but we're a news station.
But I will also mention that Donna Brazile, who was a...
She's there now.
She is there, and she was a top strategist in the Democratic Party. She ran, I believe, Al Gore's campaign, so I would not ignore the fact that she probably is having a big influence on the fact that they are bringing in these Democratic presidential candidates.
So Julian Castro was also in the state, I think it was yesterday, I think he was in Durham, maybe it was yesterday, the day before, and he too supports this $15 per hour minimum wage. This is a right-to-work state where the workers themselves have very often backed away from any unions, etc. How are people reacting to the $15 an hour minimum wage?
So his visit happened because of the McDonald's protests that have been happening this week, the rallies that have been happening associated with McDonald's. The pressure for years really has been on them to raise the minimum wage. And so, that was one of the main reasons he was here. I don't think anybody knew, though, that he was going to be.
Jonathan Lowe is a reporter anchor for Spectrum News. He's here along with Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com, Mary C. Curtis from RollCall.com and WCCB-TV, and Alex Olgan from WFAE. We will continue in a moment at Charlotte Talks. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Alex Olgan from WFAE News, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call and WCCB-TV, Glenn Birkins, QCityMetro.com, and Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News. It's the local news roundup. Charlotte City Council, as they always do, met this Monday, and among other things they discussed in front of a packed house was zoning, higher density zoning petitions is what brought those people there, because it was a packed house, as I said, and there was organized opposition to a petition by a local home builder to develop a dozen age-restricted homes on Sardis Road, among other things. Why the opposition?
People don't like high density, or at least people who live in that neighborhood don't want to see high density development come there. They say it's going to bring more traffic. It's going to do all of these bad things.
Aren't we a little far down the road to be dealing with that in a negative way? It's here. It's happening. And in fact, the city, in their new zoning meetings that they're having to develop this new zoning plan, wants there to be higher density development. We talked, I think, last week about their plans to allow duplexes, quadruplexes in single-family home neighborhoods.
So I think that which is a valid concern, the city, and we've talked about this, Mike, the fact that the city does not have a traffic policy, meaning that they don't.
No kidding.
Right. And so, you know, when you have, I work in South End, and this is another area where they're looking at high density, a high density development. Right near, I mean, the traffic in South End is horrible. The streets just could not handle the amount of cars there. We have an insane amount of pedestrians,
and
scooters.
This comes as a surprise to people?
I don't think it comes as a surprise.
When you build 10,000 apartments on a single two-block road, that suddenly the traffic is bad?
What's a surprise to people is that there's no mechanism in place to see, before we put this high-density development there, maybe we need to look at how many cars are coming through.
Is this because of previous mismanagement or management of the city? Will this new zoning person, the new city planner, understand this?
Well, I just think zoning ordinances are old and they're slow to update, and that's population growth has way outpaced over the past couple of years how much they're updating the zoning ordinances, and they just can't keep up. And when you have the demand, people want to live in South End.
But let's be clear too, we have no option to high density zoning.
Right.
There is no legitimate option. We can't just keep growing out. We can't keep building roads, bringing people in from farther and farther out. So we have to have some type of comprehensive plan that involves high density development as well as transportation.
The fact that they're worried about this at Sardis Road, I mean, anybody who's lived here for a while, Sardis Road used to be out in the middle of nowhere, and now it's suddenly they're talking about high density housing.
I was just going to say, I think there's an overestimation of public transportation use, and that's part of the problem. I think people think, South End, you'll take the light rail, but I don't think as many people are taking it as they want
and
to.
I think the study came out this week that we're one of the fastest growing cities in the country.
The average is 62 people move here a day.
Yes, and so, I mean, all of our systems and structures haven't really kept up with that, whether it's transportation or housing.
So meanwhile, there's a project bringing multifamily housing, office space, and possibly a hotel near South End. It got the green light from City Council on Monday. Where is this? What is it? And was there significant opposition or support for it?
Significant opposition, definitely. But it's going to be right at the intersection of South Tryon Street and East Boulevard. So like the Wilmore neighborhood. If you know that corner, I believe it's a bakery, Bojangles, a check cashing place, and then Saucemans, which actually has really good wings.
Let me make a note of that, Jonathan.
I'm a little hurt
we'll
that there
are more traffic in here. Thanks, Jonathan.
I'm a food connoisseur. I'm from here. A hotel, office space, but it's going to be an eight-story building. Now, right maybe two, three blocks up, they just built another really tall building. It's pretty, but they put it right on that piece of land that's across the street from Fat Burrito. So people are obviously there are more of these tall buildings that the high density that they're looking to put. But like I said, back to my original point, the traffic, the amount of scooters, pedestrians in that area, people are really concerned that there's no real plan to address the infrastructure, the roads, and they're still going to allow this huge development to come.
We're becoming a big city, and I don't think everyone in Charlotte's on board with that.
Right.
I think they want to stay a small town.
That ship has sailed.
I know.
So does anybody have any idea if as they're putting together, I think it's the 2040 plan, and updating all of the zoning ordinances because they're way out of date, that any of this is being taken into consideration?
I know congestion. Yeah. So city council members are you know, like Larkin Eggleston and Dimple Esmira are really, and Matthew Newton are really trying to push for the city to get some sort of traffic policy. But
what would that be? The cars are here, the roads are as wide as they're ever going to be. So what would the policy be?
Basically, that every other day require driving? That before you could basically bring in or do any sort of rezoning, you have to do a traffic study, essentially. Look at how many cars are coming through to determine what does that do? What does that determine for funding, for infrastructure, new sewer?
That's a conversation for another day and several thousand more shows, which I'm sure we will address in those programs.
And several million more dollars.
Yeah. In light of questionable police reaction to citizens, to situations here and around the country, police training has become a priority. But at a budget session this week, some council members advocated diverting money from CMPD training to raises for themselves. This is very confusing, and this went on for much of the week, this discussion back and forth. They've decided not to go down this road.
Well, because they can't.
That was not a good look.
It was not a good look at all.
They can't. Let's be clear, Mike. It's because the city's budget director told them that they can't reroute the funds. It's
Why not
for lack of trying. Because they want to take...
I've got the newspaper. Why not?
So this $2 million in CIT funding, or crisis...
Intervention training.
Thank you. It's a one-time
allocation. Yeah.
It's one-time allocation, which means if they give themselves raises this year, they'll have to go back down next year because the money's not going to be there.
Correct.
Okay.
So the city's budget director said that you can't do that for a recurring line item such as salaries, but the only council member to pitch this
was Braxton
Winston, but council members Luana Mayfield and Matthew Newton are the ones that suggested rerouting the funds.
So Braxton Winston said earlier this week he'd like to know what the county commissioners make in salary. That's all public information, Braxton.
Look
it up. But
sure, it was rhetorical.
Okay, because evidently county commissioners make $28,336 a year plus car, technology, and expense allowances of $17,656 per commissioner. I did look it up. That's a total of $45,992. The city council earns $19,809 a year with a $5,800 auto allowance and a $3,100 technology allowance. What do you spend $3,100 a year on technology for? That's a total of $28,709 and a difference of $17,283. Is there a difference in the amount of work that the county commission and that the city council members do to justify that difference in salary?
I don't necessarily think so, but it's never popular to, as a public official, to try and make your better benefits. I mean, they tried to go to four-year terms. People were not having that.
His reasoning, because he was quoted as saying this, so I want to put this out there, that his reasoning for bringing this up is because people who aren't
rich
can't afford to spend the time on a public office and what it entails and still be able to pay their bills.
And he's absolutely right, and that goes all the way to the top.
Right.
If you're not a multimillionaire, you really can't run for president.
Right. Right. That's why we see a lot of them that own businesses.
That's right.
The mayor, earns $25,636 a year. That is definitely a part-time job.
I did not look up what
the other allowances.
Head of the county commission makes. I didn't look that up. But I will if you want me to. They shot it down. That's not going to happen. Raises are not going to happen.
No.
Okay.
At least
not taking the money from crisis intervention.
Police training. Correct.
Training.
Okay. Do people think that, I mean, this is a part-time job, but it really isn't. I mean, when you really think about how many meetings they go to, how much time they spend in their own time studying up on issues, if they're going to be responsible about this, and most of them are, is that enough money to give them?
I wouldn't do it for that.
And they're traveling and representing the city and, you know, look at all the things that the mayor's doing.
And we're becoming a big city and more, they have more to do than they had to do 20 years ago. So, all right. So meanwhile, CMPD reports it's still struggling to recruit new officers despite millions of dollars the city's put forward for hiring and raising pay at the police department. The city appropriated $6 million. That's enough to hire 125 new officers. And they haven't filled a single position. Why?
To replace with retiring as
right.
well.
Well, that's so. Okay, go ahead. Why? Well, why can't they fill these positions?
What I've heard, little Birdie has told me numerous times, is that that a lot of them are not looking forward to working during RNC.
Really? That's a problem?
It's enough of a concern that I've heard that from a number of officers, and that they're either looking like to, if they can retire now, go ahead and retire, so they can't keep up with the attrition.
It's a 4-day event, and they're going to be police officers from every city in this country on the streets of Charlotte, as they were here for the Democratic convention.
It's so, not only 4 days though. There is lots.
I think that the riots changed the game though.
But in fairness, filling police vacancies, departments all over the country are having trouble. That's just not a Charlotte issue.
It is. But I think here in Charlotte that the RNC is a factor. The other factor, obviously, is the police and community trust is playing in that, to your point. But I have heard numerous times that they are not looking forward to working during RNC.
Also, our successful economy has meant that there are a lot of alternative jobs. They're saying that folks who might have been gone into the police department can get private security jobs.
That are safer.
Yes, and jobs. Although the police, actually, when you look at the list, they're not like at the top of the unsafe jobs. But of course, obviously, it's a safety issue. But you know, they can get a better job, better benefits working for a corporation in the area of security. But of course, the police chief is also saying that. Kirk Putney is saying that the way folks talk about the police, particularly when we have these high-profile interactions and police shootings, that is also a discouraging factor.
So if you don't come downtown very often, you may be unaware that they have been putting in bike lanes that are cordoned off from the traffic, the automobile traffic lanes. The Uptown Cycle Tracked Protected Bike Lane is what they call it. That has not meant clear sailing for bicyclists. Why?
Because people are parking in between those little plastic markers.
But that's hard to do. You have to take.
It's a talent.
You have to make an effort to do
that.
Why are they doing that to make a statement? How prolific is this?
I don't know how prolific it is, and I don't know the reasons for people doing it.
Right.
But you have to. I mean, they're painted green with a bike on it. You have to think people are doing it on purpose.
And on some of these streets, those were not parking places in the first place before they put the bike lanes. In some cases, they were, but not in all.
I always get tripped up at the intersections. I don't know if I should get in the bike lane to turn left or
Me too.
It's a steep learning curve.
It is a steep learning curve. We
have
figured it out though.
In Uptown, in the Central Business District, which is where the cycle track is, we have lost a number of the large surface lots because of all of the skyscrapers are going up.
Right.
So parking is at a premium in Uptown.
Yes. And one of the problems is that delivery trucks, like the one sitting outside our window right now, delivery trucks will simply pull over into the bike lane, make their delivery, and you're not supposed to do that. But what is their option? Seriously, if you are a FedEx or a UPS or a beer truck trying to unload your inventory to a restaurant and there's a bike lane there, what are you supposed to do?
You're going to have to walk.
What?
I mean, I don't know. What else could you possibly do?
I know. Maybe there's a loading dock. I know.
All I know is I used to be able to get a street parking whenever I went to any event, and now
impossible. It almost feels like you're asking, could they have not put this somewhere else?
But what, the bike lanes?
Yes, or the cycle track, and not take the parking away?
Well, I don't know what the options are. I don't know where you would put it.
Right.
What's the penalty if a police officer finds you parked in a bike lane?
I think they've issued some citations, but I don't know. I've never parked in one. That's my story.
Yeah,
and you're sticking to it, right?
So, Mike, CMPD and CDOT even put out a video of them this week going through and ticketing people. So,
okay, so it is happening.
It is happening.
Is it? Correct me if I'm wrong, but is it not the policy that when you repave a street in Charlotte now, you must add a bicycle lane to it? Is that not the policy?
I thought so.
Okay.
Well, we were behind in bike lanes as a city. As someone whose husband's a biker, he's let me know that.
Does he ride in single file, or does he ride several across, as most bikers evidently tend to do, and break the law?
He follows all the laws perfectly. You hear me, honey?
Right. And that's your story.
Okay. For newcomers, let it be known that for the longest time, the city of Charlotte prided itself on having honest leaders in city government until one day, the FBI walked into Mayor Patrick Cannon's office and hauled him away in handcuffs. A very embarrassing moment for him and for the city and all around, I guess. He resigned. He went to federal prison for 2 years. And now some, including the NAACP's Corinne Mack, believe he should be mayor again.
He went to jail. He got out of jail and trying to live his life. Give him an opportunity. Give him a second chance. Because God gives us many chances.
What's the story here? Why Patrick Cannon? Why this support for Patrick Cannon?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure why Patrick Cannon. I can say that not everyone on the left is particularly enamored with our current mayor, especially around her decision to recruit the DNC.
Well, I was going to ask how much.
I'm sorry, RNC.
I was going to ask how much of this is because I've detected a great undercurrent of dissatisfaction with Vi Lyles. Particularly in the black community.
To Glenn's point, I think, spot on, because yesterday, I don't know if you've all seen, there is now a social media account. It looks like a organized effort because they have a treasurer, hashtag Vi Lyles.
But why him? And if you don't like Vi Lyles, why?
Well, it's not just Vi Lyles. The banner has one term Larkin.
Wow.
What does that mean? They want him out at city council. Okay, The Observer ran an editorial this week decrying this idea, pointing out that prior to Patrick Cannon being elected, a lot of sources in the community told them not to trust Cannon. The editorial goes on to say it wasn't just that he misled the public about IRS liens a decade before, or that he made campaign claims that were demonstrably false. Cannon's colleagues believed he saw government as a way to help himself, and Charlotte soon found out how right they were. Do we want? Yes, he paid his dues. He was spent 2 years in prison. I think he had a parking business when he was mayor, and that was. I think he had to sell it. But has he? Can you go back? Can you go back to public office after that?
I think the voters are going to have to decide that. No matter what others might think, at the end of the day, that's going to be up to the voters.
Okay, we will move on to other stories, including parks and the secession movement in Huntersville. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Look who's here. Alex Olgan from WFAE's newsroom. Mary C. Curtis from WCCB-TV and RollCall.com. Glenn Perkins, QCityMetro.com. He's the editor and publisher there. And Jonathan Lowe, reporter anchor for Spectrum News. This area really dislikes seeing itself on the bottom of rankings, and the Trust for Public Lands has once again stuck us at the bottom of the rankings with regard to the 100 largest U.S. cities for parks. Last year, we were 97th. They just came out with the new ranking. We're 96th. So is there anything being done to address this problem, or are we just kind of brushing that off?
Well, it seems like the reason for the lower ranking is the distance from the everyday person to a park, which is driving distance, right, not a five-minute walk, and the size of the parks as well.
Yeah, because we're second out of the 100 cities. Number two for size, park size. Number one is Nashville, and we're only 0.2 of an acre behind them. They have 16.7 acres, the average size park, and we have 16.5, which is more important, size or distance traveled to get to a park?
I would argue distance traveled, because I think depending on how much of a size difference it is, if you're just walking there, whether it's 10 acres or 15 acres, you may not care as long as you can easily get there. And then the other metric is how much they spend per citizen or per resident. But remember, we're growing so fast that that I can understand why that may be on the lower end of things.
And Lee Jones, who is the head of Mecklenburg County Park and Recreation, says that much of this problem that we're facing is due to the incredible growth that we have. We've gone from 500,000 people to over 1 million people, he says. So we have fewer people, therefore, within a 5-minute walking distance of a park. There is money for parks in the budget. Will any of that money address this in any way?
I don't know. I mean, when we hear about like the Cross Charlotte Trail and how much money that's cost, I think people are understanding.
We don't know how much
money. Yeah, exactly.
And they're saying that they needed to buy land, but the amount of open space is dwindling. So that's local parks advocates are warning about that, too, as we've talked about earlier.
Well, pack a picnic basket, because as luck would have it, next week we're doing an hour with about these rankings with Lee Jones on Tuesday. Guest host David Borax will be in here doing that program. Last year, the legislature passed a bill granting permission to Matthews and Mint Hill and Huntersville and Cornelius to form and operate their own municipal charter schools. And on Monday night, Huntersville's Education Commission recommended not only that the town operate its own charter school, but eventually break away from CMS. Former Mecklenburg County Commissioner Jim Puckett sits on that commission.
In the long run, we believe the best course for the towns in North Mecklenburg are to have their own school system. That will take years to accomplish. So in the meantime, with pursuing a municipal charter school, and that could be freestanding or partnering with an existing charter school.
So this commission that he's a member of that recommended the charter school option and also to eventually break away from CMS, who are they reporting to? Do they report to the town council up there, or they just hold a meeting for the public and here's what we're recommending? Do we know?
I think they're just a commission that forwarded some recommendations, but it's not really clear who's getting those recommendations and then like the next step is really kind of vague.
Who appointed them?
That's also kind of vague. I will say, Jim,
really?
a name people also might remember is Karen Bentley.
Yes.
Who was also an elected official at one point in the area. She is on this commission as well.
Okay. So
I think it's kind of unfortunate that Jim Puckett, basically he said, used his choice of words that Huntersville couldn't be CMS's white knight when part of the criticism has been that they're separating because of race and economics and having to be a part of the county school system.
Well, Puckett went on to say, this is a quote, "If someone tells you I hate you and I'm not going to help you, don't be surprised if you take some alternate path." What has CMS said to Huntersville over the years that says I hate you?
So I think he is pointing to last year when the state legislature passed that bill allowing the municipal charters in cities and towns, which originated actually down on the southern end of the county. When that was passed, CMS then said and passed a resolution of their own saying any school district that does do that, you know, does pull away from them, will not receive any capital funding. And so this commission was then, you know, for lack of a better word, retaliation to that decision by CMS. And that's really what, you know, when we interviewed Jim Puckett as well on Spectrum News, he said essentially that same thing. That when, you know, you got mad, so, you know, don't be mad at us now if we take it into our own hands.
I mean, it would be a huge decrease in CMS funding if these districts or if these groups of schools were going to separate. I mean,
yeah, but also a huge decrease in expenses, too.
True.
They don't have to support those school. And one would assume that Hunters will then buy the building.
No,
right?
Well.
No, they build their own schools.
So I'll say that after.
Glenn. No, go ahead.
So we spoke to Charles Jeter.
Okay.
He is CMS's policy administrator, and this is to your question you just asked. He said, you know, okay, playing devil's advocate, you create your own charter school system. Fine. You know, that passes in the legislature. Well, there is a law that prevents the transfer of one government-owned entity to another government-owned entity. So he said, you're not getting CMS buildings. That was a direct quote. So you're going to have to essentially build a bunch of new schools because they legally they can't do it.
So Elise Dashew, who's a member of the board of CMS, has called this recommendation politically driven. Is that what it is?
I think everything is politically driven at the end of the day, but I also, I think it's about local control. Huntersville seems a long way from Charlotte. Their concerns are different. Their demographics are different.
That's because the toll lanes haven't opened yet.
Well, that might solve it, actually. It might take the pressure off.
And this is not just Huntersville, just to be
right.
clear. I mean, Cornelius is looking at this. Right. It's the North Mecklenburg communities and Matthews and Mint Hill still.
Right.
Matthews, this is where this all started. So they could
well,
still...
Well, explain Davidson, because they had the permission to do it, too, and they said, no, we don't need it. We're happy with CMS. And they're the furthest out of anybody in this equation.
I mean, it's a lot of work to set up a charter school or a school system, and there's an expense to it, and I can understand why a city wouldn't want to take that on.
I think Puck is right about one thing. If it happens, it's a multi-year thing. It's going to happen way down the road. And you mentioned Davidson saying we don't want it. I don't think we know exactly where this is going right now. I think it's going to become increasingly hard to hold CMS together.
Okay. Stay tuned. Recent laws in Alabama, Georgia, Missouri, among others, are designed to challenge the constitutionality of Roe v. Wade. That's the Supreme Court ruling that has for years now allowed abortion. Those challenges were met with rallies in support of Roe v. Wade this week across the country, including on the doorstep of our City Hall. It's difficult to understand, but they're chanting, "My body, my choice." How many people were involved in this rally?
It got tense, too. Hundreds, I would say. 100 to 200. But
why are they protesting here? Is it just because they want to show support for Roe v. Wade in the face of these challenges to Roe v. Wade?
We have an active protest group here, both of anti-abortion rights and abortion rights. There's a clinic on Latrobe Drive that gets
right.
protested all the time, and I just feel like there's a active group here.
We've done a show on the protests at the Latrobe Drive clinic, because evidently the people who are anti-abortion make it very uncomfortable for women who are going in there, not necessarily for an abortion, but for health checkups and things like that. But mostly, yes, I know you're giving me the evil eye here, but it's mostly abortion, but there are other things that the clinic does. Nonetheless, have those protests picked up speed because of these challenges around
the country? So what I can tell you is I've been out to Latrobe Drive, and on Saturdays are their busiest day, and I've heard from anti-abortion protesters that they're watching the national news about laws in other states, and even though it doesn't directly affect us here in North Carolina necessarily, it just drives them out.
Also,
ladies first.
I was just saying that when you see these laws that are so strict in Alabama, Georgia, Missouri, they're seeing, of course, they want these to go to the court, the Supreme Court, and they're seeing with Brett Kavanaugh in particular, Neil Gorsuch on the court, right. that they have their best chance to overturn the Roe v. Wade decision. And in North Carolina, obviously, we also have these protest communities, but we have in the state legislature that Born Alive Abortion yep. Survivors Bill mm-hmm. That has been vetoed by Roy Cooper by saying it's unnecessary. You already have laws to cover saving a child's life. And is it the Senate that's overturned it?
Yeah, well...
overruled his veto, and
so that's supposed to be that vote is Monday.
Yeah, and,
that vote is Monday,
and the House, they're waiting for that. So, abortion is a big issue nationally, but it's also a very contentious issue here in North Carolina, mm-hmm. and it will be one in the 2020 elections.
So, the North Carolina bill, the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Bill, is directed to physicians that they must provide care for a baby who, if in the process of an abortion, turns out to be alive.
Right.
Has there ever been an instance where
it's
that has not
extremely
been provided?
Rare. It almost never happens.
Yeah, and doctors I've talked to, they don't use that language. There's another medical term to describe
right.
that. And I think that in those cases, the reason sometimes that it's a problem is because patients want to make other decisions, and they don't necessarily, like if they know the baby is going to die, maybe they want to hold it and they don't want to give it to the doctor.
But
also... That to give you the detail on that, a doctor, they could not only be locked up, but it would be a felony if, per se, under this Born Alive.
So unlike these laws in other states, Alabama, Georgia, Missouri, elsewhere, the purpose of North Carolina's law is not necessarily to challenge the constitutionality of Roe v. Wade.
Or they didn't at least openly say that.
Okay, so right. would that be coming next?
I don't know the appetite for it, but what I've heard in some other state legislatures, like in Tennessee, is that they want to be careful and not spend lots and lots of state money on the court challenge, because these court challenges are really expensive and can cost millions and millions of dollars.
You know, it would probably imagine if, you know, the Republicans still had the supermajority in the state legislature, we probably would not be having this conversation. We probably, assuming, could be somewhat like Alabama or Georgia.
Okay. And even the folks who want to overturn Roe v. Wade are thinking it might backfire because some of these laws are so extreme, you know, putting doctors in jail for 99 years and things like that.
So the South Carolina legislature has been dealing with other issues, not this. They've approved, and I've gotten three figures here, so somebody jump in and tell me which is the right one. They've approved 115 to 120 to nearly $160 million in tax incentives to bring the Carolina Panthers to York County and their headquarters and their new practice facility. And I keep seeing these different figures, and I'm not sure why. Maybe it's because some part of that figure is the incentives, other part is economic development. I don't know. But we've been saying Rock Hill, but officially it's York County in an unincorporated area of York County.
That touches Rock Hill.
That touches Rock Hill, that Rock Hill will likely, because of tax purposes, want to annex.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, the mayor wants to.
Is that easy to do? Will it happen?
I think if they're going to give all the tax breaks, there's going to be a strong incentive to annex.
But why? They won't get any money for 15 years.
Pressure from the state legislature.
I think they are looking at it in other ways, that they'll benefit in other ways.
So this has been approved. We've been talking about this on this program for weeks. It's been going back and forth. It received significant opposition in the South Carolina legislature, in the Senate, from Dick Harpootlian, who's a senator from Columbia, because he says he saw no value in this. It's not like a manufacturing plant, but maybe it's because he wanted it in Columbia, or he wanted a highway interchange in Columbia and not in York County. But nonetheless, they finally approved it. So it's a done deal now. The Panthers are moving.
They
right?
are.
It's done.
Well, not just so people are clear, the stadium is staying in Uptown.
Right.
The games will be in Charlotte. This is just the headquarters, practice facility, training facility.
And according to what I've read, this exempts the team from paying state income taxes for players, coaches, and other employees for 15 years, as long as they use the money to build their new complex. But we keep hearing these discussions about NFL players only paying taxes in the state in which they play. So why is that an incentive?
You mean for the players or?
For the players and for the team, the coaches, the other employees, at least for the players. They only pay, I don't know who made this law or how this can be true, but I've been told by a lot of people that it's true, that the NFL's come to this agreement that they only pay taxes in the city in which they play.
I don't know how much the players have a say in this.
Okay.
What was that?
I don't know how much of a say the players
they
have
don't.
In this.
They have no say.
Right.
Okay. So they're going. Get ready. Get ready, Rock Hill. There'll be a lot of construction in your neighborhood. Tensions are flaring on Capitol Hill over attempts by the administration to block the House of Representatives from getting what they see as needed information and testimony and documents from the Mueller report and people surrounding the Mueller report. And this week, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Leader Chuck Schumer were snubbed by the president at a White House meeting on infrastructure that the president abruptly left, saying that they couldn't legislate while investigating him. And this was this week, one Republican in the House said that the president has committed obstruction of justice and other crimes that meet the level of impeachment. And North Carolina Democrat Representative G.K. Butterfield said he's getting very close to supporting impeachment.
I was willing to go through the investigative process and to have the hearings and witnesses come and testify, but no witnesses have come forth. The president is prohibiting anyone under his control to come to the Congress to give us valuable information, and we need to get to the truth. This is about respect for the rule of law.
Anybody else in North Carolina saying anything about this?
Well, it's just political chess and checkers are going on right now. Nancy Pelosi's trying to keep the House together and saying we're going to investigate but not go into impeachment because that might really hurt us for 2020. And the president, it seems like in a sense he wants them to start the hearings because he could use it as a political cudgel. More and more Democrats in the House are saying, yes, we need to do it because that's what the Constitution says.
I know that Alma Adams has said that she's closer to impeachment other
than she was before.
Right.
All right. We're going to leave it at that. Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News, Glenn Berkins from QCityMetro.com, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call and WCCB-TV, and Alex Logan from WFAE. We all leave now for Speed Street for the Coca-Cola 600. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.